From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And a very warm welcome aboard the pirate ship, the Reeve Gauche, into the Captain's Table podcast, brought to you by Are You Not Entertained? I'm Giles Morgan. I'm not actually a captain. Or indeed a pirate. But a vague ancestor of my family, Captain Henry Morgan, actually was one. And his family all came from Wales as well. This is a 30-minute romp of a podcast, where each week I simply ask my special guests to share their own personal memories of being a sports fan, and how that passion has affected and shaped their lives. Well, ahoy, as I think they say in sailing circles. It's Captain Morgan here, aboard his ship, the Reeve Gauche. Loved talking to Mark Pugach the other week. What a fabulous, interesting guest he is. But the next victim at the table is something of an Irish rugby legend. In fact, he is the ultimate Irish rugby legend. Brian O'Driscoll, 133 caps for Ireland, 8 for the British and Irish Lions, and the 4th most capped player in rugby union international history. He's the highest try scorer for Ireland with 46 tries. He's now a commentator, father, businessman. He's sort of got the lot, and an old friend. And I'm delighted that he's coming on board. And I think I can hear him now just arriving at the jetty. And yes, he's coming up the gangplank.
Brian, a very, very warm welcome to the captain's table. Pull up a chair. Watch out for the parrot who's got a sharp beak and make yourself at home. Good to see you.
Yeah, great to be here. The parrot's the least of concerns. It's the plank, walking plank that you have to worry about on captain's ships, don't you?
You do. Pirate ships. Well, we'll see how you go. You may well be taking a walk. First things first, you're in the galley. You've got 3 weeks possibly on board here. I do need to get you a drink, make you feel a little bit welcome. And it's a pirate ship. We only have rum. And I'm afraid that we only have a few drinks that the steward's actually capable of making. So he can do a fine mojito, a rum and coke, a dark and stormy, the captain's secret coconut and pineapple mocktail. Not proving that popular on the series so far, or a straight shot.
It won't be a straight shot. I like to break from the norm, but I'm also a bit of an up and down guy, keeping it simple. I'm partial to mojito, but I'm going to go dark rum and coke. Just
nice,
simple. Yeah,
very nice. We'll just get the steward to sort that out, and he'll bring that over in a second. We've talked a lot of things have been spoken about your career over the years, your own personal career and the many achievements you achieved on the rugby field. I'm very interested, though, about your own personal fan passion as a kid, particularly growing up, the things that influenced the young Brian O'Driscoll in your early days, the things that maybe inspired you to not just become a sportsman, but to work so hard as you did to become a good sportsman. What was your earliest passion? Do you remember as a fan of sport?
Well, it wasn't about rugby. Not till I was 12 or 13, and I went to a rugby playing school. It was all about Gaelic football and soccer in Ireland. From my earliest memories, kind of dating back to 4 or 5 years of age, and I was sport mad from those early memories. I was always out in the back garden kicking a ball or, you know, chipping a golf ball or hitting a tennis ball. My earliest memories date back to, again, about that age where, through accident, I became a Man United fan. And, my cousins were from Manchester and they came over and visited once. And they asked me who I supported in the Premiership or the Championship as it was then. And I said, I don't know who I support. And they were like, well, you support Man United.
You were
and
given that.
And they, that
they,
was it.
They bestowed that.
That was it.
You.
So at that time, you know, most of my friends, they're either Man United or a lot of Liverpool supporters because that successful Liverpool team in the 80s. you know, the Dalglish and Kenny and the Ian Rushes and, you know, we had a good few Irish footballers playing, Ronnie Whelan, Ray Houghton playing, you know, Steve Staunton, you know, latterly playing at Liverpool. So it was an easy team to support. But no, because they came over and bestowed it upon me, that was my decision forevermore. Could so easily have been, you know, the blue side of Manchester, which would have been a grim last 20 years, decent the last two or three. But other than that, no, I got a good, I lucked out.
You got to thank your cousins for that. And so that little boy, that little Brian O'Driscoll, he's told who to support. He presumably gets the kit and gets excited as little boys do that. Here's my allegiance. Who is your standout player? Who is the one that you was, or probably a few in those days, but was there one that you got, oh, that is the person I want to be?
Yeah, it was. It was comfortably Mark Hughes was a boyhood hero, and you know, it's always someone that I've looked back on, and I remember my childhood through supporting him. It would have been, you know, I remember buying, you know, the United video VHS in 1988, where they finished 11th. I can't believe Man United were selling video VHSs where they finished 11th. Just, I suppose this shows the size of the club. But Brian McClair and Mark Hughes were vying for top scorer, and my friend Donovan, who lives down the road from me, was Brian McClair, and I was Mark Hughes. And I guess I loved a multitude of things to his game. First and foremost, you scoring these spectacular goals, but I loved the edge that he had as a striker when it wasn't expected of you. You know, it was of a time when Gary Lineker was playing, where I think Gary Lineker never got a yellow card, which meant he never made a tackle, whereas Mark Hughes was getting a yellow card every other week. And as much as you shouldn't be endorsing that, I just liked that he was in for the fight. And there was very few tap-in goals. He had this incredible volley, you know, brilliant strike from outside the box, and just the nuggety way that he played the game, all aggression, all elbows, all physicality, that felt a little bit ahead of its time, or certainly during that period of football, there weren't that many other strikers playing that way.
And do you think he, in a way, the way you describe that, it feels a bit like a rugby player. He played it very physical. He wasn't diving. He was playing.
Yeah. Well, like, you look retrospectively, and I don't know, you can tie the two together, that was why I liked him. I liked him on its own because he was doing things that others weren't. He wasn't conventional. He wasn't adhering to the norm of what was expected of strikers of that time. He was doing his own thing. And I had a lot of respect for that. And it was like he had this built-in frustration within him. I don't know why. Maybe he had his own reason, but it looked as though he, you know, it was his opportunity to vent that frustration and getting physical, getting involved and making life hard for defenders. You know, when he had the ball, but nearly more often than not when they had the ball. And it was, it just felt that he was quite different, and I really enjoyed watching him play.
And it strikes me, I think, he's one of those people, sports people, where he put it, that aggression was for the field. Because on the field of play, I don't know if you've met him.
Yeah, I have, yeah. And he couldn't be more different. Very quiet, very placid, really softly spoken. And I'm always intrigued by those individuals that are, you know, one type of person on the field, and then they revert back to type of, personality type of being quiet and unassuming. I'm like, how are these two ulterior egos?
Well, someone we both know very well, and you played a lot of rugby against, is a good friend of ours, George Gregan, who is the most mellow man, the most laid-back human it's possible to be, until he was on the pitch and he became something possessed.
Yeah, and you wonder which is the version of them that's truest to form. I still don't know the answer with those. I can think of a handful of other individuals that you wanted to hate on the rugby field, but are, you know, Mike Phillips, who I played with on the Lions tour in 2009, 2013. I roomed with him in 2009, and when I saw my name on the room sheet beside his, I thought, oh, Jesus, here we go. and then you know, you've got preconceived notions as to what sort of people these are because of how they behave on a rugby field or in a sporting environment. And then you go and meet them and it's totally different. And, you know, I have a great relationship with Filsy now and he's good fun. And provided, you know, you take some of what he says with a pinch of salt, he's good for you. You know, yeah. He's good to be around. And yes, he was a pain in the arse out on the rugby field.
When you were a little boy, watching sport in Dublin, and I guess that could have been both rugby, football, GAA sports, who took you to sport, to matches in the early days when you were getting that kind of the sense of the smell, the burger van, the kind of the smell of beer, the all of those things. Do you remember who, did you have, was there an uncle or your dad?
My first memories of going to a rugby match was, I think it was 87, Ireland, France. My dad would have taken me.
And so you'd have been what, eight? And,
what yeah, so 8 years, probably 8 years about old. Eight, yeah. It would have been a Five Nations game. My dad obviously was a keen rugby player. He played twice for Ireland in uncapped games against Argentina in 1970. So I didn't have a clue what was going on. There was a local guy from where we were living in Dublin, in Clontarf, playing at fullback. So I was really just eyes on him. I call Ferguson Lee. He only played a couple of times for Ireland, but I remember sitting up in the stand, and like you say, you know, as a young kid, it's about the sweets and it's about, you know, the food there. And I see it in my own kids now. The experiential parts of life are about lollipops and or going on holidays and being allowed to have chewing gum. I'm like, do you know how much money we've spent on this holiday? And your recollection is going to Disneyland and being able to have some candy floss.
I'm like, oh, we could have done this really cheaper version of this.
That was before my love for rugby was ever developed and honed.
It was more the experience, right?
It was. It was going out as a day out. And I used to go up to the rugby club with them, up to the Clontarf games. And again, rugby's quite a technical game. You've got to know an awful lot of rules to really appreciate it. And so it took a while for that penny to drop. Football and Gaelic football was a lot simpler to understand and to play.
And tell me about that the whole Irish sport thing, the Gaelic Association. It's something that we've spoken about in the past. I'm fascinated both in terms of both games, in terms of Gaelic football and the hurling, but also the way that the support that you've talked to me in the past about, which I'd love you to share, which is why the support for the various clubs and provinces exists
and
in the way
and counties. Yeah, it's a county basis. So it's the best way to describe it, it's community based and it's so parochial. It's like, even though a county like Dublin, you know, who've had huge success in the last 5-10 years, and everyone's, you know, saying how unfair it is with the player numbers, and in some respects that's true, but you go down to rural parts of Ireland and the hub of the community is the Gaelic football team or club, and that's where all the socializing is done. That's where, you know, people get out of their homes and get to spend time with friends, family, and so on. It's the nucleus of what community is about.
Do you choose your county, or are you born into?
No, born into your county. So
you
players,
you can't unselect.
No. There's been one or two contentious calls on that in recent years, where a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of players will be working in Dublin, but yet will have to go back to their county 3 nights a week. And that could entail a drive up north or a drive down to Limerick, and some, I'm sure, to Cork, just to play football with their county team. And I suppose I say that lightly, just to play it, it's a huge honour, but what a difficult thing to do, to enjoy your passion, to play at the highest level as they are able to do. You've got to make huge sacrifices in your life. And that's what is so amazing about the Gaelic Football Association, is that, or the GAA as it's known in Ireland, is that it's an amateur game. And these players, besides some expenses, are doing it purely for the love, and it's ingrained in them from a young age. And that's why I talk about the sense of community and the parochialism of it, is because it's what they've grown up knowing and loving, and it's inherently in them, and they will inherently pass it on to their kids and their kids' kids. So,
and do you therefore see a great difference either in rugby in Ireland or in football in places you've watched football around the world? Is GAA, the way it's supported and the sense of fan, completely unique to anything else you've seen? Or does it remind you of maybe a local derby in the third division in football or soccer, as you'd say?
No, it's quite unique. It is. Like you look at Croke Park during the summer, obviously the championship is played from May through and through to, is it all, yeah, late August now. And you get, you're filling Croke Park and some, again, it's an amateur game. And now the women's final, Gaelic football final, got 43 or 44,000. So that's, you know, growing year on year as well. And it's, you know, the commitment, and I'm probably laboring the point, the commitment of these men and women to the cause of playing. And they, you know, they have to go and do a day's work and then, you know, so they'll train, certainly from a Dublin perspective, I know that they'll train early morning, 6 a.m, then go and do a day's work. And then sometimes they'll be training in the evenings as well. And they are frighteningly fit. And there's one individual, a guy called Jack McCaffrey, who's who's a doctor now. So trying to be a doc, an intern on top of all of that, but yet winning All Ireland's to beat the band is like mind blowing. You must have no life.
It's like
that.
The old rugby union.
It is. Yeah, it is.
But it looks
is.
Like their physicality has gone to another level of the modern sportsman.
Yeah. You know, and obviously, if you go back to Gaelic football 20 years ago, the level of fitness would have been nothing on now. It feels like they're professionals without being paid. That's why the GAA is quite a wealthy organisation.
And do you love going? Is that something you love going to?
Yeah, I do like going to the games. I think...
would you have been any good as a player? Were you any good as a Gaelic?
I was a reasonably good Gaelic footballer. I don't think I had the eyesight for hurling. You know, I had quite bad eyesight as a kid, and well, right into my late 20s before I had my eyes lasered. So I would have been a pretty reasonable footballer. In fact, I changed school as a 12-year-old to go to Blackrock College or Willow Park, and in my final year in junior school, in primary school, my team got to Croke Park in my absence, and I was like, oh my God, I've missed the opportunity playing in Croke Park. Alas, it came along.
It did. And how?
You know, 20 years later.
Yeah. And you obviously now, a lot of your career is about broadcasting. You talk a lot about rugby on the TV and you're doing a wonderful job. When you're at home and the kids allow you some time, and maybe they don't, but what's your absolute joy of sitting down and watching sport? What is the sport that Brian O'Driscoll sits down, puts his feet up on the coffee table, maybe a beer, and goes, I'm now in my zone of sport?
I think back to moments. It's probably golf.
Is it?
I think back to the Open this year. And I was up there working at the Open with HSBC for, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And actually Sunday morning, I left and came home. And I think back to what a great day it was. And I was happy out being at home. I was cooking, you know, Sunday dinner, and I had a glass. I opened a bottle of wine and I was watching the golf and jumping around my TV room and trying to make sure I didn't burn the spuds. And
did you?
And no. I think I managed to keep it together. Funny, that wasn't my residing memory from that day, what sort of shape the spuds were in.
I know you're a massive fan of sport. Sport brings out unbelievable highs in fans and also great troughs of low. When was the last time you cried watching sport? Or have you? And I must just apologise to the listeners. We're in the dry dock in Portsmouth, if you believe the pirate ship metaphor. And they're obviously refitting an aircraft carrier right next to the pirate ship. Hence the noise. It's not on the ship.
The last time I cried, I would have been close to emotion on seeing Shane Lowry lifting the claret jug. I don't think quite movie style where the tear rolled down my cheek, but I would have felt very emotional for him, seeing the enormity of it and how much it meant to him, and also how much it meant to the support of the country.
You couldn't have written that script, could you? You really couldn't. It looked, I was watching on telly and it was one of the nicest guys on the circuit, undoubtedly.
He's a super, super nice guy. There's a reason that there's a popularity for him, and it's not a popularity of people that don't know him. It's also, I spent a bit of time with him last week in Abu Dhabi, and it's a popularity of everyone he walks by. He knows everyone. He's got time for everyone. And he's the sort of person that you know will absolutely not change on the basis of the success that he's had. Life has changed for him, but he hasn't changed for it.
Yeah, no, he's for me, having worked like you with a lot of sports people over the years, he for me is a beacon of how it should be. He's the most approachable person. And when he won, it was a big moment. You've travelled all over the world for sport, playing sport, and I think for many people, when I've asked the greatest game of rugby, you probably don't remember, which was that second Lions test in South Africa when you were knocked to shit. What events have you not been to? And there are probably quite a few, but what's on your bucket list that you would love to go to as a punter?
I'm not one for watching golf live, really, for running around and trying to position yourself. Again, you know, I don't have 20/20 vision, so to be able to see the ball and, you know, position yourself in the right place, plus the manner in which they hit the golf ball, you know, I don't have eye-head coordination to actually see the ball move that quickly. But I do like the idea of going to the Masters. I believe it's an event that you should experience once. So that's up there. The Super Bowl, yeah, but just to say, and to eat all the dips that and hot dogs that you know you see referenced around big NFL games, just gorge yourself.
The whole experience.
Yeah, it's not. It's not just a game of football.
I know you play, you're lucky enough to get invited to pro-ams whilst your fame still is relatively high. I think you even played with Lee Westwood, who won recently at the HSBC in Abu Dhabi, which was wonderful to see an old boy like Lee turning back the years.
He learnt about the speed of the greens from my first putt on all 18 holes being 15 foot by. He was like, "Oh, they're quick."
Did you find when your drive? I mean, you're a handy golfer, but when you find your drive goes a certain distance and then the pro stands up and takes it's a different game. Did you find that exciting, terrifying?
Yeah, I think you don't have the full appreciation for them as sportsmen and women until you play with them and understand. You close your eyes and you hear them hit it. That sound is different than how you and I hit the ball.
No, it's very different.
and it's a real pleasure, particularly a ball striker like Lee Westwood. And I've played golf a couple of times with him, and he's a super, super nice guy, and you can see the warmth that people have for him, particularly on the success. You know, to win four decades is pretty impressive. But the level of goodwill speaks volumes for the individual. But I'm always amazed at their consistency and their unwillingness to balk under pressure. In nearly all cases, of course, they all have their moments. But, you know, the most terrifying place for me in playing pro-ams is on the driving range. I tell you one, right? I was at the Dunhill my first year, just retired from rugby, and I can't remember who the pro was. It was one of the South African boys, and I didn't know who he was. Anyway, I got a wedge out, and I'm nervous, and we're all pretty tight. Anyway, he's hitting driver. So he hits driver and his tee goes out like a pace or two, and he goes to pick his tee up, at which point I hit my pitching wedge and I have a shank. Right. And his caddy is standing behind them. So he goes out to reach for it and it literally whizzes by his ear as he goes out. And I look at his caddy and he's looking at me, and I just motioned my finger up to my mouth saying, "Let's just keep that between the two of us." And I literally put my bag back in my club back in my bag and walked off.
That's it. I don't need any more practice.
I was like, it's my nemesis. Talk about losing confidence on the range.
Yeah, it doesn't do you any
good. Because no one's watching you, but you think, oh my gosh, you know, they're interested to see whether I can hit it. They don't give a shit. They are just focused on their own thing. And when you have a couple of duffs, you get it gets into your head. So no, when I go to pro-ams now, I get my driver out and I hit, because I can guarantee that I'm going to make contact with it and pretty well.
And it'll go somewhere along the way.
Do you know what? Yeah.
Doesn't really matter where.
Yeah, they're not, you know, if it goes 30 yards right or left, it gets in the air and it's about building a bit of confidence. My wedge, no more.
Well, we'll put that away. What sporting hero have you not met that you'd love to meet, or even if it's posthumously? Is there one person that you wish you could have shaken hands with as a fan?
Funny, I've never really been. Like, you talk about Muhammad Ali's of the world, of course. Would you be better for having met him? Yes, definitely, to understand the mystique and the aura. Because he had the gift of the gab as well as that sense of aura when he walked into a room, or so I understand. There's other people, you know, someone like David Beckham has that aura, but yet conversationally probably doesn't back it up. Whereas I remember walking into a room before and shaking hands and going, there's a mystique to that.
Yeah.
So beyond that, I've got to meet Mark Hughes. Genuinely, he is literally. Wow. And I've met him a couple of times, and actually Kevin Moran took a picture of us the first time, because Kevin Moran knew I was a huge Mark Hughes fan, and he took a picture of the two of us, and I was like, yes. I checked it later on and it was completely fuzzy. I was like, oh my God. And now that I've had a photo with Mark Hughes once, I can't really go and ask it. Not that he remembers it, but I can't ask him again. In my head, I'm like, he's going to think I'm a bit of a psycho if I look for another photo
stalker,
with him.
Yeah. Not that stalker.
So now, I'm like, anytime I'm in his company in some regards, I like hand someone a phone, going, take a couple of sneaky photos of me and Mark Hughes, best buds.
We got to the part of the show which I call the captain's broadside, where I'm just going to ask you fairly quick fire questions, answer as best you can. So, what's your favourite sporting stadium to watch sport in?
To watch sport? Croke Park.
And would that be rugby, or would that be...
No. Gaelic games.
Gaelic games.
Yeah.
The full biff.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's your favourite place to watch sport outside a stadium? Do you like being at home? Do you like being in the pub with mates? Is it...
I like watching sport at home. I love Masters weekend.
With mates, or just pretty much solitary experience?
I'm happy enough being on my own. I really am. Yeah.
What's when you go to Croke Park, say, what's your favourite, and it's probably, you know, sin food, obviously, but what's your food of choice at halftime?
You know, you
got the Vans.
Yeah.
Where are you going?
I like a pie.
What's your filling?
Steak and kidney.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not
fussy when it comes to
filling. I'm not fussy when it comes to it. Yeah. A good pie. I'm always a bit sketchy on burgers in those places because I've seen people in their hands when they haven't been making burgers, or watched them going for a wee beside you and straight back out. I'm like, oh gosh. So I like something with...
But you like cooking, don't you?
I do like cooking, yeah. I should be better than I am, because I do really like it.
But you quite often, I know you on social media, you post about sort of food that you've from your, I think you've got some sort of oven barbecue contraption.
Oh yeah, yeah. From my Kamado Joe. Yeah. From the egg. The egg's been in hibernation for a while. I need to break it back out again.
Will that be for the summer?
Yeah, it shouldn't be. It should be. No, there will be. It should be out. It should be an all year thing. I just have, it's a weekend. It's an experience. It's a full Sunday, because slow cooks, you know, really need to get going at 9 a.m. and that's not always opportune when, you know, I always have a Sunday to be able to do it. So when I get a bit more time, it's something that I do love doing. And like I said, break open a bottle of wine. And I like the idea of entertaining on Sundays, having friends and over, because kids can come together and you have a few drinks together and then they're gone by 7 o'clock and everyone's in good shape for Monday. Yeah.
So we've got a steak and kidney pie. We're at Croke Park. We're watching the Gaelic games of some description. And are you a lager, bitter, or are you a stout man? Are you a Guinness man?
Yeah, I'm a Guinness man.
That's excellent. Okay, so you've come aboard this beautiful ship and we're free to sail anywhere in the world that you want to go. Where would it be?
New York.
Okay, well, that's very easy. We just head west. And here we are at the table. I better feed you. It's only right. I'm going to give you 1 3-course meal that you choose the menu. The cook isn't great, but we'll get a good sort of guest chef in for one night. I'm going to give you a cheese course free, so you get that.
Okay.
What's your 3-course meal?
Can I work backwards?
You can do what you have you like.
Bread and butter pudding with custard for dessert.
Are you going to eat it in reverse?
No.
You're just choosing.
Yeah, because that I'm trying to buy myself some time in thinking of the others. I'm going to go dessert, starter, main. I'm going to go a jumbo prawn with very specific spicy Mary Rose type sauce, but I like them. So there's a particular place, a steak restaurant in Dublin that does them where they just sit them around the bowl. And then, but the spiciness of the sauce is really important, but also they've got to be big, juicy prawns or shrimp. As
we should be able to get
for your American listeners.
Yeah. Well, we'll get those in the Atlantic. That should be easy.
Yeah. And then this might be more difficult. As someone in the Atlantic, as someone that has gone off red meat in the last few months, not gone off, just being conscious of eating less of it, because not because of game changers or anything, but just because I felt as though I was eating too much red meat and cholesterol is definitely something that I have to control. I do love a big, filthy ribeye steak. And so unless you're going to cull the cow on board.
No, you can have the ribeye. And what are you having with that?
I'd like some onion strings and some creamy corn and better throw in, I don't know, a few greens just to
keep, so you don't get scurvy.
So the gout keeps itself.
Keep the gout away. We've also given you a fabulous cabin in the boat to get you to New York. The shower is a power shower. It's a good one.
Okay.
What song do you sing in it? And I have heard you sing, so I know
it's
singing
great,
is part
of it.
Well, it's expressive.
It has not backed up your ability on the piano, that's for certain. I would probably sing like some Irish folk, probably, yeah. So like Christy Moore, Black is the Colour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look forward to hearing that. The crew will be tittering behind the door, no doubt. Do you have a hidden talent? And I don't mean from a sports point of view. Is there something that you can do, like juggling or something, that you've got a gift for, or not really?
Not really. No, unfortunately not.
Maybe cooking now.
It's not even a gift. I'm all right at cooking. I should be better than I am because of the enjoyment I get from it. But it just shows that cooking is absolutely about talent as well as practice. And it was an argument that I used to have with a pal of mine's girlfriend years ago. She used to just think that there was no talent in cooking. I was like, that's nonsense. Everyone would be a good cook then. There's talent of understanding how things come together and pulling a plate together. So I don't feel as though I'm there. I'd love to take time out and
would you do
years to come and do? Yeah, I think
got
I will.
Cooking schools in
no,
Ireland,
we do. You? Yeah, down in like Ballymaloe, I was given a weekend for my wedding 10 years ago. So I must go and do that one of these days.
Yeah, you probably ought. Do you remember the first album you ever bought?
Yeah, Michael Jackson, Bad.
Okay, and do you still have it?
I mean, it's a cassette.
It's a cassette.
Yeah.
Do you have a cassette player?
No. Although it's funny because when we moved house recently and in the shed, my wife had boxes of cassettes that had been sitting there since she moved in. So it's like 10 or 12 years ago. And I was like, you do know that we don't actually possess a cassette player. And by the way, there's mold on these, but she didn't want to let her youth go.
She could. It was those things. And back in the day when we were all kids, you used to make tapes of cassettes for people as well. It was a thing.
Yeah, I used to be big on that. Yeah. And then, yeah,
the playing record.
At the same time. It was like, they don't know how good they have it these days.
These bloody kids, they're spoiled. That's what they are. Final question. If you could smuggle your most treasured possession, I'm not talking human or animal or anything like that, but most treasured possession on board, and it's a pirate ship, so we're good at smuggling, and we could bury it safely somewhere for you, what would it be?
I'm not really. It's funny. I'm not really a possession
You're not
type
a hoarder.
Person.
No. It's clearly not cassettes either.
I'm a memory person rather than a memento person, and much to the chagrin of my wife, as we've just found out. But you know.
So do you have a trophy cabinet at home?
No. No.
It would have to be a pretty big room, I guess.
I've got an office at home that there's stuff in probably in the shelves, but a lot of stuff will be up in the attic too, like the glass and stuff. I've got medals. I think I know where my medals are. Yeah. But then again, if they were gone, if somehow they were taken away, it doesn't mean anything.
You've got
it's
the memories,
not,
you know.
Yeah.
What?
So I don't think I have something that I really love and cherish. It's about
the next meal, and that's coming.
Yeah,
which is good news.
Great.
I can smell it now. Brian, we could talk for ages. You're a wonderful, wonderful ambassador for the sport, and you're a wonderful friend. But it's been a real pleasure for you both to join me at the captain's table to go along with my metaphor of being on a pirate ship. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Good luck.
Blimey, that was a bit special, hearing from Dricko talking about his love of...
Particularly, I think I was very taken by his absolute passion for Manchester United and for Mark Hughes. It's always fascinating for me to hear from sportsmen and women who have are already in their own pantheon, but they have their own god and goddesses who sit within there. And clearly, Mark is someone who Brian has idolised for many years. Moving on, in the weeks ahead, I have got a wonderful list of guests coming up. Lawrence Dallaglio, Jonathan Davis, Lee Westwood, Ian Poulter, Ernie Els. But I'm really thrilled to say that next up will be another Irish sportsman who is relatively well known. Rory McIlroy will be coming on to the Reeve Gauche and sharing with me round the oak table his own joy of sport, his own love of sport, which I think is well documented. He's a proud Man U supporter as well. I'll be interested to know who his heroes were growing up. So we really look forward to having Rory on the show next time here on The Captain's Table, brought to you on Apple Podcasts. And we'll look forward to seeing you next time. Bye-bye.